We want gold in exchange for our muties. Precious metal, not a stinking slip of paper.
We don't have any gold here.
Then we'll keep our muties.
You two signed on to train and fight along with the others. Sorry, no pets allowed.
Well, consider us unsigned.
Great and Bell didn't give two hoots in hell about the baby scagworms, or how they got paid for them. What he and Kirby were looking for was a quick handle on the island's personnel and their pecking order. Intel they could convert to their advantage. The blonde man stepped forward.
Now that you're here, you can't back out.
Before his cryogenesis, Colonel Bell had played in the big show. The Pentagon DoD League. The Byzantine corridors of power, intrigue, and one-upsmanship. A world champion button pusher, he knew how to read people and their weaknesses. He read this guy as a total fruit loop. His psyche a squirming pile of contradictions, of desires and fears working at cross purposes. From the top of his too tall head to his size 13 feet, the guy radiated arrogance, vanity, insecurity, and self-loathing.
Surrender the muties and take your chit. I guarantee you'll be paid in gold later.
Hey, who the fuck do you think you are? This is Magus's op. We want to see Magus. We want to talk to Magus.
Sylum's pale face and high-rise forehead rapidly took on an unhealthy ruddy glow. Button pushed. Sylum was not in charge. Bell had to give the guy credit, though. He didn't respond by shouting back or reaching for a hidden weapon. He didn't do anything stupid. Instead, he raised his hand and beckoned for backup. The colonel took one look at the 300-pound enforcer and started shrugging out of his two-frames backstraps.
Oh, it ain't worth the trouble.
Yes, you have that right.
As he passed over the scagworms to Aang, he saw the self-satisfied expression on the blonde man's face. The guy actually thought he'd won, but he'd lost. Bell had neatly established the island's chain of command. And if necessary, the top-to-bottom kill sequence he and Kirby would follow. Before that moment, Bell's greatest concern was that the one in charge might be the naked ugly thing, whose desires and intent he couldn't read. Inscrutable, alien. There was no exposed button to push, no obvious weakness to exploit, no way to manipulate it to his advantage. For a reason that had nothing whatsoever to do with outward appearance, it reminded Bell of a Kodiak bear, a creature capable of almost unthinkable violence, whose trigger was internal, accessible only to itself. Looking into the enforcer's slitted yellow eyes, he had no clue as to what flipped its switch, just the feeling that it was either on or off. Kill now, or kill later. After Kirby handed over his rack of tubes to Aang, he snatched the payment chit and stuffed it in his pants pocket. Like the people in line in front of him, they weren't asked to give up their weapons before they hopped the barrier. Well short of the end of the pier, Bell caught his partner by the arm.
Hold up. Let's wait for the geezer.
Right. We need to start breaking the news to him. Get an idea of how he's going to react before he goes off and rejoins his pals.
Bell nodded in agreement. The inevitable reunion of Doc Tanner and his companions presented a problem. They didn't know exactly when or how Doc and friends were going to make their move, but had no doubt that a move of some kind was upcoming. From the Gaudy House stories where they'd heard about the crew's past exploits, they were certain that signing on with Magus's freebooters to pillage the hellscape was not the real agenda. From the companion's reputation, it was more likely some kind of preemptive strike against the recruitment operation. Or a ripoff. Or an assassination attempt. Or even a bit of all three. Once Doc linked up with his running buddies and their plan was put in motion, the main chance for winning him over peacefully would be lost. Taking him by force was the last resort.
How do you want to work this? Two-on-one or one-on-one?
We'd better make it one-on-one. Tanner will be less likely to get his panties in a twist that way. Find us a campsite and I'll lay it out for him as gently as I can.
Bell leaned on the pier's rail, watching Doc amble toward him. All their effort, their suffering, their sacrifice had come down to this. For an instant, desperation fluttered like a big fat moth in the back of his throat.
It was on tiny, remote, lifeless islands like this that Roman emperors exiled their political enemies, troublesome relatives. Suetonius writes that the Lady Agrippina endured exile in such a place, victim of Tiberius Caesar's treachery.
Gaius Suetonius Tranquillius. Sex and violence, circa 2nd century AD.
You know his work?
Through a series of filters. I saw some television films based on the books of the poet Robert Graves, which were based on the histories of Suetonius.
You saw these films recently?
Only you and I would call 100 years ago recently, Dr. Tanner.
Doc pulled back to a proper fighting distance, switching the sword stick to his weak hand and tucking the tail of his long coat behind the walnut grips of his Lamaan.
You have the advantage of me, sir. I know you by a number around your neck, not a name. Who are you? And more to the point, what do you want from me?
Bell licked the ball of his thumb and used it to draw a clean stripe down his right cheek.
These red spots on my face aren't from getting shot or burned or anything like that. It's freezer burn. I went into cryosleep days before the nuke cost.
You and your large friend?
Yes. We went under at the same time in the same place. My name's Bell. This is Kirby.
If I may ask, what prompted you to consign yourselves to deep cold prior to Armageddon?
I suppose you could say it was a premonition of doom.
Any charlatan psychic could have that prediction, but few, if any, could act upon it in the manner you describe. How did you come by this premonition, and how did you get access to the machinery of cryogenesis?
You already know the answer.
Your white coats.
Not just any white coats. Dr. Kirby and I were theoreticians, pure researchers, although we were funded by Operation Kronos.
Kronos? By the fires of hell!
Whoa there! We worked independent of that bureaucracy, without close supervision, in areas of our particular professional interest. In the course of our investigations into some unusual electromagnetic phenomena, we got a glimpse of the near future. Our computer models predicted doomsday.
And so you decided to desert the ship you helped scuttle.
That is an oversimplification based on insufficient facts, and you know it.
If you and Dr. Kirby were able to anticipate the nuke cost based on a computer model, the primary cause must have been evident. It had to be part of the calculations. So tell me, what precipitated the world blowing apart?
Graydon Bell had read Tanner's Kronos files 100 times. He and Kirby had discussed their implications endlessly, both before and after their cryosleep. Theophilus Algernon Tanner was obsessed with guilt over leaving his young family to an unknown fate. Tanner's suffering was a mirror image of Bell's, a button in common.
It was you, Dr. Tanner. You caused the end of the world.
By thunder! You had best...
The second time jump you made from 1998 to Deathlands was the pivotal event.
Oh, if you know about that... Then you know it was not my choosing, nor was the initial jump. I was taken against my will.
Yes, you were. But the hard fact is this. When your physical form was transported from the 20th century to the near future, damage was done to the fundamental structure of existence, to what Dr. Kirby and I choose to call supra-time-space, or STS.
You can call it anything you want. What proof do you have of any of this?
In the beginning, all our proofs were mathematical, rational, not empirical. But they led us to suspect that a vantage point outside our own existence might exist. After you were trawled from November 1896 by Dr. Herman Wells, Kirby and I began monitoring subtle changes at the submolecular level. That damage was the first indirect evidence we had of STS. We tried to persuade Dr. Wells and others in power to call off further Kronos experiments until our data could be analyzed elsewhere and the results independently confirmed. Despite our warnings, you were set on to the future.
The consequences being?
Almost imperceptible electromagnetic shifts, which at first caused only minor isolated problems in the world's most sensitive and sophisticated computer systems. The problems were kept out of the news for national security reasons, and because their impact on performance was negligible. The troubles were blamed on viruses and on faulty software and hardware. In less than a month, the random charge shift suddenly cascaded, disabling the nuclear fail-safes and triggering an immediate all-out global exchange.
I was the instrument that destroyed your world.
Yes.
Apropos, as you destroyed mine.
What if I told you it wasn't destroyed?
I'd say you were stark raving mad. My world is dust. Yours is ashes. I repeat my original question. What do you want from me, sir?
I want your help in undoing what has been done.
As if such a thing were possible.
I assure you it is. Dr. Kirby and I didn't freeze ourselves to escape the nuke cost. We did it so we could come to Deathlands and find you. Gaining access to files to discover how far into the future we were sent was very difficult. We took a calculated risk that we would actually thaw on the preset dates.
I am flattered, to be sure, but I fail to see where all this is leading.
There is a way back to your Emily, to Rachel, and little Julian.
It already exists. It is within reach. We can show it to you.
I should destroy you now, like a rabid dog.
If you do, you'll never know if I'm telling the truth. You'll never know if you could have seen their faces again. If you could have lived the life that was stolen.
Doc let the sights of the Lamar drop from the man's crotch to the planking at his feet.
There's only one stipulation to the deal, and it is non-negotiable.
Why does that not surprise me?
You can't mention any of this to your companions. Not a word about what I have offered.
Assuming your offer is bona fide, you expect me to take my leave of Ryan and the others without saying goodbye? These are my dearest friends, my battle mates.
Goodbyes are overrated. It's the hellos that count, especially to a long-lost family.
I don't understand.
When you leave with us for the past, your existence in Deathlands will be completely erased. If you were never trawled from Nebraska in 1896, you could never have arrived here. What's the point of saying goodbye to people who won't remember you a nanosecond after you go?
Doc seemed to wobble on his feet, as if from a physical blow. The possibility had finally sunk in that this might be the answer to all his prayers.
I need time to think.
Go ahead and think. But remember, if you say anything to Cawdor or the others, the offer is withdrawn. You will remain in Deathlands forever. Your family will be forever dead to you.
Doc nodded, still dazed. Bell hadn't told him everything that he and Kirby knew. The truth didn't depend on obscure mathematics. It was simple Aristotelian logic. Caught up in the resurgence of lost hope, Doc wasn't thinking in an organized way. He hadn't asked the most pertinent question. Perhaps the truth would dawn on him someday, a eureka moment, after he returned to his own time. For everything, there is a price. Caveat emptor. Let the buyer beware. From his position at the end of the long line leading up to the barricade, Jack Lauren watched the exchange between Doc and the Mutie Hunter. He was too far away to hear any of what was being said, but whatever it was, Doc took serious offense. His antique handgun cleared leather in a blur, and for a second it looked like he was going to cut loose on the empty-handed, rapidly talking man. Jack knew he had seen the guy before, him and his black partner. And he knew just where. In a rowdy trailer house gaudy beside a fallen Interstate 15 overpass, southwest of the ruins of Vegas, the companion's last stop before making the jump to California. The white paint had struck a deep and sensitive nerve. When Jack had glimpsed that pale, gaunt face across the crowded, smoky saloon, his heart jumped, and he dropped his spoon into the plate of hot chicken pie he was gobbling. For an instant, he actually thought he'd found another albino. Without a word, he left his friends at the low corner table. When he moved closer to the man, he saw the troweled-on pigment and brown eyes. Not an albino, a seedy clown. Embarrassed and angry at himself, Jack had turned away before the man noticed him. Or so he'd thought. When he'd seen the pair again, below decks on the white ship, talking with Doc Tanner, his hackles had gone up big time. Jack could only think of one way the Mutie Hunters could have gotten to Morro Bay so fast. Unless they had sprouted, and subsequently lost, wings, they too had used a Matrans gateway, and it had to have been the same one the companions used. The Mutie Hunters had either followed Jack and the others to the Desert Mountain Redoubt, or they had known it was there all along, and they knew enough about gateway operation to follow the companions. What the pair was after wasn't clear. Jack realized it might not have anything to do with the companions. The Matrans jump could have been the easiest way for them to reach the Morro Bay rendezvous point. Or it could have been something more sinister. The agreed-upon mission rules left Jack in a bind. Until they were in a position to make their assault, the companions were supposed to keep strict distance and not intervene on each other's behalf. It was every man for himself, with the exception of Mildred and Christy, who were teamed up. Not wanting to endanger his friends or the mission, Jack had kept a discreet eye on the situation. There was no doubt Doc could handle whatever the Mutie Hunters dished out, and it was always possible that he already knew about their Matrans jump, that the man had volunteered the information. It was also possible that Doc remembered them from the Gaudy's pie parlor, so a warning was unnecessary. Whatever the Mutie Hunter had said to Doc, it devastated him. As the old man moved down the pier toward the island, he dragged himself along, stiff-legged and slow. Jack could only watch and worry. Doc's brain had a tendency to overload, to vapor lock, a product of the damage done to him by the Operation Kronos Whitecoats. It was hard to know what would set it off, or how long the problem would last. Sometimes it was over in a matter of seconds. Under the circumstances, all Jack could do was hope for the best. It had taken quite a while for Jack to reach the barricade, which gave him plenty of time to size up the Mutian enforcer. He had never seen anything sweat like that. Perspiration constantly peeled off the knobby skin. And it didn't work alone, which was odd. Muti-Norm collaborations were rare in Deathlands. As a rule, Mutis were either hunted for sport or worked as slaves by their pure gene betters. A creature as large as the Enforcer was something you might see caged and chained in a Muti zoo or a carny show. It was too big and too powerful to control with threats of physical pain or deprivation. Too big to control with voice commands or hand gestures. Although the guy with the double-stack forehead was doing just that. As Jack stepped up to the barrier, the Enforcer showed him its tongue. It licked at the air, eyes narrowed, like it was concentrating very hard, memorizing the molecular signature of his scent. The tongue lashing stopped, but the sweating continued at a steady rate. The Enforcer stayed put.
Your number?
112.
Right. Good luck, little Caraco.
Jack didn't know what a Caraco was, but he gathered it was not an insult. He instinctively liked the man. Both were free wild spirits, fighters. Jack on land, Aang on sea.
So, that's the lot?
Yeah, that's the last one.
Right. In that case, as soon as you have the Muti cargo unloaded, I want you and all your crew on the beach as well.
What?
Your presence is required on the beach.
Why?
You didn't bring me enough recruits this time. You're at least 20 bodies short.
Aang carefully tucked the logbook into the back of his trouser waistband, freeing up both hands. The shoulder-holstered government Colt was practically lost in the folds of his left armpit.
Look, Silo, a lot of people got chilled on the trip down. Way more than usual. I do my best to keep them all alive, but I can't control everything that happens between here and Morro Bay. I'll make up the difference next time. You know I'm good for it.
No. I think you have to make up the difference now.
Jack watched Aang's facial scars suffuse with angry blood, like crimson tiger stripes.
I am an islander. I am captain of my own ship. I will sail on the next tide with all my crew, whether you pay us for this trip or not.
You will sail when I tell you to. Until then, you will do as I say, or I will have your precious ship scuttled while you and your crew watch.
Aang's right hand crept toward the butt of his .45 caliber Colt. Silum raised a single finger. Before the captain could yank the gun from its holster, the Enforcer stood between him and Silum, blocking his shot. The Islander and the Muti were roughly the same height and weight. There, the resemblance ended. The Enforcer leaned forward and extended its tongue, waving it in Aang's furious face. The captain did not retreat, but he did not draw his weapon either. Behind him, uniformed soldiers raised their assault rifles and took beads on his crew. The other Enforcers left the beach and ran onto the pier.
Make another move, Captain, and that ship will be your coffin. And the coffin of all of your crew.
Jack expected Aang to fight to his last breath. After all, he hadn't shied away from battle with the Tawa. But the captain hesitated. He looked at the exposed, razor-sharp crescents of Amber Horn, carefully weighing the odds that he could clear leather and get a shot off before his insides were flopped down around his bare feet. Meanwhile, the Enforcers sweating started a brand new puddle.
Crew! Unload the cargo! Then disembark! Will be needed on the beach.
You've made the right decision.
Silum and his two-man entourage walked back toward the island. The captain stepped up beside Jack.
There's an important lesson here, little Caraco. A lesson I already knew, but chose to ignore for the sake of a nice profit. It's the same lesson everybody in Deathlands is taught at their mother's knee.
Be down with the devil. Wake up fucked.
Bright boy.
Thanks.
Ryan carried his steaming dinner to a nearby flat rock. After taking a seat, he gingerly held the bowl up to his nose.
Well, not too bad.
Anything hazardous lurking in it had been boiled to death, which was comforting as the soup looked like a bad case of Montezuma's revenge. Dark flecks of seaweed and nameless chunks of gray flesh floated in a watery mocha gruel. And as he investigated deeper, he found other stuff in it too. Rubbery stuff that wasn't animal flesh. Not abalone either, or clam, or even squid. Ryan picked a piece out with his fingers and examined it.
Ugh.
Far down the beach, the Islander captain and his crew were huddled together in a circle eating their soup. All of it, Ryan noted. He hadn't expected them to sign up for Magus' new army. From their expressions, they hadn't either. If the Islanders appeared standoffish and arrogant on the ship, on land they looked downright hostile, ready to lash out at anyone or anything. There was nothing on the beach that hinted at an impending attack. There wasn't anybody else on the island but them. No weaponry, no vehicles, no training centers. Just the six naked, sweating trainers.
Ugh.
As Ryan forced himself to drink the liquid, he watched the long-haired guy leave the pier in a small rowboat with his two pals. The smaller pair struggled with the oars while Salem lay stretched out in the bow, his ankles crossed, his forearms cradling his oversized head, like the Queen of Sheba. Ryan watched them disappear around the point. He had Salem pegged as a talker, a bullshit artist, definitely not a fighter. If he had a weapon under that baggy shirt, he kept it hidden. But it was obvious he controlled the trainers, and that put him squarely in charge of the whole beach show. In Ryan's experience, Magus always put people like Salem, weak-willed, foolish, internally twisted, into positions of authority. They were living buffers between Steel Eyes and his victims, and easily sacrificed if the natives got restless and wanted some payback. Not that Magus was averse to getting his own hands bloody, but he considered large-scale wet work to be manual labor, and therefore beneath his virtuoso talents. If the killing had nothing to do with him directly, with his secret experiments, or with personal revenge, he kept his distance. Distance was required to soak in the full effect of a mass slaughter. Ryan had no doubt that Steel Eyes lurked somewhere close by. It was in his nature to spectate. And this operation had all the trappings of a made-for-Magus extravaganza. There was psychological as well as physical suffering on the program. Magus enjoyed nothing more than wringing the emotions of his intended victims, playing with their hopes, and force-feeding them nothing but horror. All Ryan knew about the vast block of granite to his back was that it was the highest point in the Baja before the new cost, and at that time there was an astronomical observatory sited on the peak. He suspected there had to be a Mattrans unit as well. It was a likely spot for a redoubt. It was extremely isolated. It was made of impervious rock. Prior to Armageddon, it was 10,000 feet above sea level, and it had a white coat installation already in place. Once again, Ryan checked the position of each of the companions on the beach. Everyone looked okay, except for Doc. The old man was definitely not okay. He was talking to two muti hunters on the wet rocks, but he wasn't looking at either one. Doc faced the empty sea.
You're offering me my family.
You would see Jolien and Rachel again. You would be able to see them grow up and bloom. You can live your life with Emily.
Live a safer, cleaner, simpler...
Saner.
Yes, saner world. More hopeful.
It would undo the nuke cost, the greatest tragedy in human history. It would save the lives of untold billions.
It would also mean that I would betray my closest friends moments before a terrible battle. I would be like unto Judas Iscariot.
Your friends are known to the country as incredible fighters. Don't worry for them.
It is not their health I worry about. It is a question of my turning tail in a crisis. Tell me more about this supra-time-space theory you men have.
According to our calculations, existence itself is made up of an infinite number of simultaneously unfolding parallel chronologies of timelines, untold possibilities and permutations existing side by side, but hidden from one another.
Following this, if you return to your original timeline at the precise moment of your departure, it would start a new unfolding with its own self-driven evolving consequences. The Deathlands experience would remain in your memory, but Deathlands to you would cease to exist because you would no longer be part of it. Such as the prison of human perception.
Would the Deathlands timeline move on without me? What will happen to my companions?
Does a tree falling in a deep forest make a sound if no one's there to hear it? The problem, as stated, is circular and unsolvable. There's simply no way to know.
And what if I meet myself when I return to my time? What are the consequences of such a paradox?
Nothing will happen, because the paradox is an illusion of perspective. You can run into the other Tanner, but you can't meet yourself. You aren't the same man who was trawled against his will in November 1896. You've lived years longer than he has. Your body consists of different molecules, arranged in a different order. You don't occupy the same space. Your perceptions are not identical. His destiny is not yours.
I could kill him then, with no harm to myself?
Perhaps you could. The theory of SCS also predicts that individual timelines are similar to living organisms and that they are constantly repairing themselves within finite limits.
So, if there are infinite strings of existence, then there are already realities where the new cost did not happen.
Undoubtedly, but not any that we observe. So then to us, they do not exist. Perhaps if you stop the destruction of civilization, your companions would be living in a lush green world. A world of peace and stability.
And it would all be because of me.
It would all be because of you.
Doc took some comfort from that, even though he knew that the consequences of a jump back in time couldn't be predicted with any certainty. Though his mind was reeling, his scientific training had not deserted him. The vantage point of STS was mathematical, imaginary, the product of time-imprisoned human brains, and by the theory's own definition, suspect. Infinite lines of parallel time, like guitar strings, vibrating at the touch of an invisible hand. Entire universes completely oblivious to one another, yet closer than the atoms that made up his own skin. If Doc Tanner hadn't already seen evidence of the existence of parallel worlds with his own eyes, he never would have bought into Bell and Kirby's story. But what they proposed seemed entirely possible. A while back, he and the companions had broken bread, rattlesnake actually, with black-suited warriors from an overpopulated, doomed Shadow Earth, something he chose not to mention to the Freezies. Doc weighed his options. If he did nothing at all, his future was clear. He would spend the rest of his life in torment, wandering the hellscape in mourning, raging at the unfairness of his fate. No drug, no liquor existed that could ease his pain. No frenzy of killing or orgy of sex could still his terrible anger. He either remained in this strange, brutal world, or risked all, abandoned all, to return to the peace and civility of Nebraska, to home, to his real life. He weighed the sweat and blood he and his companions had shed over the years, the shared danger, the constant battle and hardship. He owed them everything, a debt so large it could never be repaid. Ryan, Christy, Mildred, Jack, and John Barrymore had kept him alive long enough to see and seize this final opportunity.
Kill it!
Sylum backed deeper into the hallway to avoid the possibility of being hit by flying gore. It was culling time in the menagerie. They already had more than enough scalies for the afternoon performance. Even though this one was exceptionally big, about 600 pounds in its crusty stocking feet, it had to go. By nature, they were pouncers. In the wild, scalies sat still for long periods of time behind cover, waiting for prey even dumber than they were to stumble past. The biggest specimens were capable of quick movement only in very short bursts and over very short distances. In an arena where they did not have the advantage of cover or surprise, they were largely a set dressing that could be relied on to bleed profusely and die on Magus's command, as the 600-pounder did now.
Yes, good. Write that down.
Yes, Lord Magus.
Shall we continue?
Yes, we are done here.
Magus turned down the corridor, leaving the enforcer to clean up the considerable mess. Overhead, in the volcanic rock ceiling, a series of rebar-grated openings let much-needed sunlight and fresh air into the subterranean maze of muted coops. Sylum walked five strides behind his lord and master, and Sylum's two hangers-on followed. 12 feet away was his minimum comfort zone. Any closer, and Steel-Eye's aura seemed to invade the very marrow of his bones, sucking away his energy, making it difficult for him to breathe. Magus had a shambling, lurching gait because his right leg was a good deal shorter than his left. Muscle and bone had been more heavily trimmed on that side to remove gangrenous bits. The remnants of living flesh could only be stretched so far between the titanium struts. To keep his balance while walking, Magus had a habit of throwing his left arm in the air on every right-footed stride. He looked like a ghastly, life-size marionette, animated by an unseen, spastic puppet master. The island's saltwater environment had worsened Magus's range of motion problems, stiffening his artificial knee and hip joints. The corrosive atmosphere attacked even the hardest steels, and the high humidity promoted bacterial growth and sepsis. The joints of meat to metal were particularly vulnerable to weeping sores. As a result, a lengthy and thorough cleaning was part of Magus' daily toilette. Magus was very secretive about his bodily functions, even his eating and drinking. Sila knew he used various machines, remote robots, and video cams set up in his playroom to perform hygienic tasks and make repairs and modifications to himself. Sila disliked visiting any part of the island's redoubt and had never been invited into its upper reaches. He had seen the playroom, though. It was the abattoir cum machine shop where steel eyes relentlessly searched for self-perfection. A more efficient mechanical heart, more sensitive internal gyros, a better fit between his various human and cybernetic components. All this required constant experimentation upon living subjects. It was getting harder and harder for Sylan to tell where Magus the mechanism ended and Magus the living being began. Harder to say what, if anything, of the original creature remained. Whether Magus was improving himself with his incessant tinkering was difficult to decide as well. Sylan was neither white coat nor physician. He was an artiste, a visionary. He could only judge success by the pungency of the aroma his lord and master gave off. Magus lacked the faculties to measure his own stink. His olfactory sense had been destroyed during the implantation of his chromed steel replacement eyes. Of late, Magus had been smelling particularly sickly sweet and funky, a very disturbing sign. The reek reminded Sylan of his Uncle Lester on his deathbed, a man who had started out a genius and finished up with shit running down the backs of his legs. It wasn't rad cancer that did him in. He had poisoned himself by accident while working the Hammurabi grift. Uncle Lester had made up Hammurabi years before Sylan was born, on day 7 of an 8-day jolt binge. By the time he started auguring in, but before he took to plucking every hair from the left side of his head, he had drawn a highly detailed sketch of the graven idol he named Hammurabi. It had 7 skull heads on long, snaky necks, heads representing fire, plague, pestilence, radiation, mutation, flood, and chemrain. It was more of a commercial than a religious revelation. Sylum's uncle took to traveling the hellscape by oxcart, showing off a homemade statue of his hideous god with its 7 bobbing skull heads, and spreading the new gospel according to Lester. To all who would listen, he made predictions of impending disaster and calamity. At night, before moving on to the next fill, he poisoned selected farm fields and wells, a process he called getting the buzz going. When he circled back around 3 or 4 weeks later, the buzz was going strong, and the people still alive were primed for the bottom line. Only by sacrificing valuable goods and services to Hammurabi through its chosen intermediary Uncle Lester could anyone hope to escape the god's wrath. Abandoned at a tender age by a family that considered his skull shape a threat to their norm standing, Sylum began riding in the back of the Hammurabi oxcart. On a daily basis, the boy witnessed the power of even the most mediocre fiction on a slow-witted, ignorant, and laughably gullible audience. People were afraid of Uncle Lester because of Hammurabi, his jolt binge fraud. That fear allowed him to separate the Hicks from their gold, from their gear, and if possible, the virginities from their teenage daughters. It was an important life lesson for the narrow-shouldered, meaty-headed whelp. As Sylum matured to manhood, it became obvious that he was much more gifted at making up scary stories than Uncle Lester, whose generally weak line of bullshit constantly needed human intervention, poisonings, kidnappings, and murders, to get and keep converts to the faith. For Sylum, hands-on was always a last resort. When Uncle Lester's health started to fail due to all the toxins he had sown in the service of his make-believe god, Sylum inherited the oxcart and the pitchman job. His descriptions of plagues of boils and burrowing mites kept his hayseed audiences itching until they bled. They cringed at his stories of invasions of rats and fleas, carrying mutated diseases that ate the eyes and tongue from the inside out. They blanched at tales of midnight visitations by packs of hungry cannies and stickies. Sylum had quite a little operation going, and he knew how to control even the smartest of his victims. A dirt farmer had once incited Sylum's wrath and forced his hand.
Why does God only do bad things to people?
Because that's what gods are about. Or haven't you noticed?
I've heard talk about a place called heaven.
I don't know anything about this heaven. I've never even heard of it.
You're missing the point. The idea is to do something about the here and now, to make our lives less horrible, which is why we sacrifice to Hammurabi.
Although the farmer had backed down, the other stump puller seemed to take what he'd said to heart, and the collection plate had suffered. Overnight, the smart-mouthed bastard swelled up so big he couldn't get out of bed, so big they couldn't carry him through the cabin door. Silent was 2 miles away when he heard that the man had actually exploded. He had let out a great belch, and the open flame from a candle set him off, killing him, his wife, and one of their 3 kids. A bit too much of Uncle Lester's tried-and-true recipe that time. Months later, Silent awoke from a sound sleep and saw those steel eyes looking down at him, lit by the embers of the dying campfire. He knew at once who it was. As a youngster, he had thought the tales about the steel-eyed half-man, half-machine were fables, primarily because the facts were so disjointed and contradictory. He didn't understand until he was much older that therein lay their strength and their terrible fascination. Magus personified unintelligible science and mindless human hubris. He was a living symbol of the hellscape. In the flesh, he was the scariest thing Silam had ever seen.
I saw you today.
You did?
I enjoyed the Hammurabi show. I liked it very much. The plagues, the boils, the unholy pestilences were described in great detail. I particularly enjoyed watching the people beg for forgiveness after you poisoned their fields. It was too late for those fools to get religion. But not for the relatives and neighbors who had to watch them die in agony.
Thank you.
I could use a brain like yours, Silam.
Silam's sphincter had seized up. He had thought Steel Eyes intended a transplant, but that turned out not to be the case. It was an offer of gainful employment, a grander living god to serve, and he had served faithfully. In the menagerie's next muti coop, shiny black, cylindrically shaped creatures scuttled through the deep piles of straw on the rock floor.
Now those creatures definitely look promising. Silam, I trust you lined up some hardier Norm stock for the afternoon's entertainment. The group this morning put on a truly pathetic performance. I'd rate it 1 star out of a possible 5. The muties tore their opponents to shreds well before the final act, so there was no final act. It was all build up and no crescendo. Very, very disappointing.
Yes, sir.
Lowering his top-heavy head, Silam knew better than to argue. But he knew there had been nothing wrong with the previous group of Norm fighters. The screams from this side of the island got very loud at times. Left waiting on the beach too long, their firearms already confiscated, the recruits had guessed their fates. The uniforms had had to use guns and cudgels to drive them from their driftwood hovels and into the rowboats. It was understandable that they hadn't gotten into the joyous spirit of the morning's contest.
I'm getting bored with this diversion of your asylum. Frankly, it's not living up to its initial promise. It's all complication and no substance. It's wheel-spinning, directionless, redundant. It has become a hollow mockery of itself. What else can you offer me?
Perhaps, would you be interested in a grand finale, Magus?
Oh, anything grand and final interests me.
I have added an outlandish twist to the afternoon's performance, something I hope you'll find appealing.
Go on.
I've conscripted our Islander captain and crew. As you know, they are renowned throughout the hellscape as savage and determined fighters, a tightly knit band of brothers, cousins, and fathers. They will do themselves great honor in the arena, you can be sure of that. And when the final act comes, it will be brother against brother and father against son.
The spin doctor noticed a spreading wet spot on the floor between the metal strutted legs. Magus had sprung another pinhole leak in his tranny. Rish and Jazzwinder noticed the puddle as well, but said nothing. Rish just buried himself in his clipboard, keeping track of the number of muties and their fighting capabilities, just as he had with the newly arrived recruits. The data was indispensable for staging the upcoming contests, and for developing the charts of victories and defeats, woundings and killings he used to predict outcome probabilities. The odds-making was not for gambling purposes, but to ensure Magus got the very best in live theater. The entourage continued down the underground corridor, following the lurch and jerk of their master. Xylem glanced into the cells and cages that lined both sides of the hall. Some of the races of captive muties had been given names by the people of Deathlands. Stickies, Scalies, Swampies, Wazzies. The menagerie Stickies were chained together at the ankles and necks, this to keep them under control at all times. As Xylem passed their cell, the naked muties looked up and sniffed through the holes in their faces where noses should have been. They showed him their needle teeth and drooled, playfully reaching out between the bars with sucker hands. Their idea of play was not his. The cannon fodder Scalies were unchained and caged in same-sex pairs, squatting amid mounds of their own dung.
Feed me! I don't even know how long it's been since I've last eaten!
Please! We need food!
Shut up, or I'll send in the Swampies!
The leather-winged reptilian Wazzies barely glanced up. Their long, tapering wings had been clipped on arrival, so they could barely fly. Next to the cages lay the steel mesh nets and prod poles necessary to pacify them. They didn't need them right now. Next up were the Swampies, a race of sour, squat, hairy, blockheaded humanoid muties. Their beards and arms were still splattered with blood from the morning's fight. Crude clubs in hand, their dark, squinty eyes carefully measured their captors for a murderous bludgeoning. There were other muties, too, species specially imported by Megas. Species no one had ever seen before. One was the size of a small dog, with prominent fangs like a Tasmanian devil, bulging reddish eyes, and a long, naked, rat-like tail.
Oh, that's right. Get riled up for the fun.
The next cell contained five norm-looking females, ages roughly 13 to 15. Their mouths were gagged and securely taped shut. Their wrists were bound in front of them with more tape. They looked like virgin wraiths from some pre-dark Nordic myth. They had long, pale blonde hair woven into a thick, single braid down their backs. Their porcelain white skin revealed a faint tracery of bluish veins. Their eyelashes and eyebrows were the color of corn silk. Pink tea roses tinted the centers of their cheeks. They wore long, gauzy white gowns, gathered under their budding breasts by belts of colorful woven rags. Staring up at him from the straw where they sat, knees drawn up to their chests, their piercingly blue eyes radiated lethal hate. Xylem had dubbed them Screamies. An obvious choice, as screams were their primary offensive weapon. Not normal screams that you could actually hear, screams that might make you cringe or shudder, but high-intensity screams that shot up into the ultrasonic. When riled, Screamies rolled their eyes back in their sockets, opened their perfect pink lips, revealing black teeth, a black tongue and mouth, and cut loose in unison. The sound they made tore eardrums apart. It burst blood vessels in the eyes and nose. It disrupted heart rhythm. At close range, it destroyed brains. In battle, they advanced in a solemn procession, two abreast, palms pressed tightly together, obliterating all that got in the way. Xylem found himself with a sudden splitting headache. Riss shut his eyes as he too was stricken. Jesswinder suffered the worst of all, springing a copious nosebleed. The humming had no apparent effect on Magus or the enforcers.
Let us continue.
The last cage in the corridor was made of clear plastic and sat on a low table against the wall. To the uninformed, its contents would have seemed an anticlimax. It was full of flies. Inside the transparent cage was a sort of hive. The hive's foundation, all but obscured by the mass of black hairy insects that crawled over it, was a decapitated human head, stripped of skin and flesh down to the crimson bone. The bugs paraded in and out of the nostrils, eye sockets, mouth, ears, and neck stump. They were not houseflies or horseflies or deerflies. They were muties, born of and shaped by the Nukost. These insects both bit and stung their victims, savagely swarming and attacking anything warm-blooded. Their venom caused massive tissue swelling. After many stings, the accumulated toxins incapacitated the prey, bringing on a partial paralysis, which allowed the flies to bury their eggs in every square inch of the helpless body. The victim was still alive when 4 days later the larvae hatched out and ate their way to freedom. Once freed, they turned around and ate the nest. According to Xylem's running script, The flies were to be withheld until a pivotal moment in the combat, when their release would become a complicating factor and make things even more interesting. As they continued walking, Xylem thought about Magus. After years of service, there was so much about his master that remained a mystery. Magus was in the habit of disappearing for extended periods of time, months even, and then returning without warning or explanation. Sometimes he came back less aromatic and more energetic. Sometimes he came back with new servants, like the Enforcers. Xylem had no idea where they had originated. It was entirely possible that the sweating muties had been on the island all along. The upper levels of the secret redoubt, Steel Eye's private domain, was a veritable cornucopia of pre-dark treasures and unheard-of technology. How Magus moved about, where he went, and what he did, was a puzzle that had no answer. At corridor's end, beneath a huge, tightly grated roof opening, was a foyer of sorts. The menagerie's only exit, a pair of heavy steel double doors, stood ajar. With Magus in the lead, the parade left the underground chamber, stepping on the edge of a dish of mostly beige rock, 100 yards in diameter. The islet on which they stood was roughly 2 acres of coarse-grained volcanic tuff. To their backs, framing the steel doors, was a low, broad cone of solidified volcanic ejecta. Nothing grew in the wind-sculpted bowl. The natural arena was surrounded by a flat gray sea and overlooked by the towering mass of granite some 150 yards away. The islet was a sacrificial altar. No place to run, no place to hide. High in the island's sheer cliff face, weak sunshine reflected off a rectangle of glass, the window of Magus's private skybox. Here and there, the islet's porous rock was stained black from the blood that had soaked into it. The Enforcers had already collected the edged weapons dropped during the morning show, but were still cleaning up the wide scatter of body parts, gathering them up and tossing them as far as they could into the smooth sea. By spinning, discus thrower style, they could chuck an arm or a leg a very long way. A rowboat waited at the shore.
Come, Xylem. Follow me. Leave the lackeys behind.
Of course. Rish, are the odds for the game calculated?
Yes. The order chosen will guarantee a memorable fight.
Very good.
Xylem cocked a finger, and 2 enforcers joined them at the boat. After Xylem braced himself in the bow, the enforcers pushed off and began to stroke for the far shore and the southerly flank of Devil's Peak. There wasn't enough sun for Xylem to make out the pale spine of the reef, bracketed by plunging depths on either side, but he could see the mass of dark purplish shapes hanging in the water just below the surface. Attracted by the rhythmic splash of oars, the dark shapes rushed toward them. Mutated dog-toothed cargo, 200-pounders, peered up at Xylem through a foot or two of water, their canine fangs long, straight, and pointed, like killing dirks. Dozens of broad backs rode in front of the boat, the orange-red skin showing through the thick horn-like plates of scale. The mass of wide purple backs followed them, all the way to the other shore. With Magus in the lead, Xylem walked along the foot of a precipitous cliff. A cleft had been cut, or blasted, into one of the perpendicular granite buttresses. The nook was angled so it could not be seen from the water. It concealed a doorway made of dull gray metal.
After you.
As the elevator car started moving, a crushing sense of doom descended upon Xylem. The car was just 10x8. No windows, no air, no headroom. Just Magus at arm's length. As the elevator started up with a jerk, he pressed his back hard against the wall, fighting down towering and familiar waves of panic. Steel Eyes was not a creature he could kill, nor raise a hand to. He was afraid even thinking that thought, that Magus would sense it somehow and strike him down. As the car rocketed upward, the poet laureate frantically rationalized the urge he felt to prostrate himself, to grovel face down in the tranny drip. He didn't want to die. He didn't want Magus to vivisect him, to laugh that awful laugh while he peeled back the layers of skin and muscle and fat, yarding out his intestines, playing pity-pat with his beating heart. Magus could not be battled or bartered with. What he wanted, he simply took. The 10x8 vanadium steel box, with no one to see or hear, their true relationship was revealed. Xylem was in control of nothing. He understood nothing. Ego gone, intelligence gone, spine gone. that Magus had one day discovered him was base self-flattery and more bad fiction. Steel Eyes had turned him out. Dr. Antoine Kirby rechecked the mag in his M16. It was a nervous habit he picked up. Too many firefights and too many hellholes had left him with the persistent nagging feeling that every mag was a bullet or two light, no matter what the round counter said. Bell noted Kirby's tick. He was plenty anxious, too, and with good reason. Two-thirds of their escape route was exposed to up-angled fire. The rope-railed path up the cliffside was long, narrow, steep as hell, with a sheer drop-off to the beach, and had more than a dozen tight switchbacks to navigate. If Doc Tanner didn't come along under his own power, they were going to have to cold-cock him and drag him by his boot heels. Either way, unless they got a big jump on their adversaries, they were in trouble. The Freezy's main advantage was surprise. No one would expect them to bolt in a vertical direction. That, and the fact that they more or less knew where they were going. Because Kirby and Bell's redoubt had not been looted and ransacked, they had access to vast amounts of pre-dark information, both inside and outside its strategic confines. Its surviving computer banks allowed them to identify other undestroyed redoubts in the global system, and to remotely monitor their Matrans activity and ambient power levels. Redoubt linkage and communication had been critical to the re-establishment of social and political order post-Holocaust. Order that had never come. After following Doc and his companions to Morro Bay, and learning the direction of the voyage was south, they had a good idea where they were headed. They already had confirmation that the Devil's Peak Redoubt was operational, and that its advanced cyber and Matrans systems were in use. It was also the only functioning facility within range of a 3 to 4 day sail. By a strange quirk of fate, Kirby had actually visited the site once before, during a visit home to California while he was on semester break from Princeton. Some mathematician colleagues of his at the University of Mexico, who worked at the National Astronomic Observatory, had invited him up to the summit to have a look through the installation's 2.1-meter telescope. Before the new cost, the remote Baja mountaintop was the second-best viewing spot in the world, after the Mauna Kea Observatory in Hawaii. Outside the computers of their redoubt, the Freezy's main source of information was gossip and rumor gathered along the hellscape's overland trade routes. There was a certain undeniable consistency to some of the stories about Magus. Steel Eyes was reported to have appeared in a variety of places separated by long distances, distances impossible to span even by WAG, if the dates were even close to being correct. From this, Kirby and Bell had guessed that the companions weren't the only ones using the Matrans system. There was other gossip as well. Widespread rumors of Magus's time traveling, of his popping back and forth between the eons to steal whatever material or weapons or slaves he fancied. Kirby and Bell had dismissed this tale out of hand, based on their STS models. Their computer simulations had shown the first jump or trawl of an individual caused a slight degradation in the timeline's fundamental structure. The second jump initiated catastrophic anomalies. Because Kirby and Bell couldn't risk creating that catastrophe, they had used cryosleep to reach Deathlands. Their first time jump to the past would be their last, with a minimal disruption to the time stream, at least theoretically. They did not dare return to the year 2001 or anywhere near their own era. Their conclusions about the laws of STS were derived from a model, and therefore not 100% certain. While 95% reliability was close enough for science, this wasn't an experiment that could be repeated over and over. This was the whole ball of wax. If they had somehow miscalculated, dropped a decimal point, added instead of subtracted, failed to convert from metric, that 1 in 20 chance of being wrong could come back to kick them and the hope of humankind in the ass. Forever. Because of the unacceptable consequences of failure, Kirby and Bell planned to enter Tanner's newly unfolding timeline a century after 2001. The 100-year delay would give Bell's children a chance to grow up, no matter what happened, and it would give science a chance to prepare itself for their arrival and any potential unforeseen consequences. To this end, they had prepared a special blast-proof, heat-proof, radiation-proof capsule for Tanner to take with him. The inch and a quarter-long canister, worn on a neck chain, was not to be opened until the year 1997, before the time-trawling experiments began, and then only by Operation Chronos Whitecoats. The Freezies had decided not to use computer technology for their vital message to the new past. CD-ROM discs or tape mini-cassettes or memory chips were too easily damaged and the information lost. They had chosen microfilm, a universal, optically-based, hard technology. Primitive, but virtually foolproof. On the tiny strip of film were details of their work, of the fledgling Kronos technology, of the consequences unregulated time trawling had wrought, and their planned reappearance down the time stream. Some of those consequences they had purposely kept back from Tanner. According to their STS model, a third jump by the same person in the same timeline would literally vibrate that string of existence apart. After Doc Tanner made the next jump, Deathlands would suddenly and violently cease to exist. Not just from his perspective, from all perspectives. There would be no sound of a tree falling after he departed, because there would be no tree, and nowhere for it to land. Kirby and Bell had opted to not fully mention that part.
Hey, what the hell is this?
Don't you tickle blisters!
What in blazes?
It looks like our hosts are making their move.
You'll take my blaster when I'm dead, you fucking beauty-loving creeps!
Ryan watched, slightly to the side. It was the beginning of a weapon-by-weapon confiscation campaign.
We assure you this is merely the first part of the training. We need to make sure that your hand-to-hand training is carried out as best as possible, and that can't happen with the crutch of a blaster.
My ass, it can't.
This wasn't in the contract! What are you trying to pull?
The odds were tilted in the favor of the recruits, who numbered about 70 in all, versus 30 uniforms and now 8 trainers. A couple more of the sweating muties had popped out of the woodwork when their backs were turned. With their guns at the ready, the recruits grimly faced down the uniforms and the trainers. They weren't going to give up their weapons without a fight.
Please, please, let us settle this like gentlemen. Thank you. Now, as I said, as soon as the hand-to-hand training is completed, you will all have your blasters back. I will allow you access to your blades. Everybody has to play by the rules here. And the rules say the blasters stay behind this afternoon.
Nobody takes my piece.
A grizzled ex-Mercy stepped forward. His long, tattered black overcoat flapped around his shins, and he waved a worn Soviet TT-33 Tokarev in the air like it was Excalibur. It wasn't a gun worth dying for, in Ryan's opinion. The Soviet ammo was rare at best, and even if the gun had been converted to the widely available 9mm, it still had a clumsy feel in the hand, not to mention the problem of the barrel bushing wearing out.
You want to eat again? Or do you want to starve?
I want my freedom!
Fine!
Ryan had missed the hand signal. It wasn't just about silencing him. It was an object lesson. The two men who were standing closest to him were also splayed on the ground, leaking blood from a dozen holes each. The trainers surged forward and, seemingly without effort, batted random ex-sec men and mercies off their feet. The muties loomed over their fallen victims, amber talons exposed, ready for gutting. But they stopped without drawing blood. Because the attacks were so tightly focused on a few and over so quickly, the recruits didn't respond with answering fire. Instead, most moved to whatever cover they could find. Ryan had his SIG pointed at the captain's head as the man spoke again.
Get this straight! Neither you nor your blasters are going anywhere! You're stuck on this pile of rock in the middle of hell! If you want to get off, if you want to get back to the world still breathing, you've got to play by the rules!
Intent on keeping his weapons as long as possible, Ryan slung the Steyr and slipped to the back of the pack, near the waterline. The other companions did the same. JB looked over at him and shook his head, the barrel of his M4000 shotgun cradled in the crook of his arm. It was a bad scene. Risk piled on risk. Like it or not, they couldn't make their move yet. A major gun battle would spook Magus for sure. They had to get close, inside his guard, before they showed their cards. It was a typical Magus production. Just when you thought things couldn't get worse, they did. And by then it was too late to retreat. As Ryan watched the uniforms take the recruits' weapons, his scalp began to crawl and prickle. He sensed an impending, out-of-control crescendo. He felt the companion's vulnerability, and his own. The trap's jaws were already snapping shut.
It's time to go, Tanner, while they're busy with the others.
Doc slowly rose to his feet. One by one, he looked to his old friends. Jack, the fearless wild child. Mildred, his colleague, his critic, his intellectual equal. John Barrymore, ever dependable and stalwart. Christy, her beauty and fighting spirit like a blinding beacon. And Ryan Carter, dear Ryan. A hero for the worst of times. The new Dark Ages. None of the companions looked back at him. Their attention was on the impending confiscation of their weapons. It was almost as if he had already gone. As if he had already been forgotten.
Please forgive me, dear friend, but this intolerable heartache must finally end.
Come on, Tanner, now! We gotta go now!
With Doc sandwiched in the middle, the trio ran for the cliff path, then dashed up the grade. The path was only a yard wide, and the footing was slick from dripping water. Without the rope to hang on to and to pull on, speed climbing would have been impossible. The braided rail ran along the right-hand side of the zigzag track, passing through stanchion posts on the trail's outside edge and steel rings hammered into the rock on the cliffside.
Rex! Run as hard as you can!
I'm trying.
I got you! Keep going!
They're shooting at us!
No, they're not! Not yet, anyway!
They kept climbing, rounding the switchbacks, moving ever upward. 200 feet above the beach, Kirby glanced over the sheer edge and saw a pair of enforcers running full tilt from the pier.
They're on to us.
Shit!
Keep running! We gotta get higher! They can't shoot at us at such a steep angle!
One of the trainers is gaining!
An enforcer was already catching up, and the cloud bank that concealed the mountaintop was still far above them.
Shit! You guys keep going.
No! You can't stay behind!
Go!
Kneeling at the point of a switchback, Kirby flipped his M16's fire select to full auto. He didn't have to wait long.
Motherfucker! It's still stayed!
Doc's heavy Lamar filled the air with black powder smoke. When it cleared, though, the trainer was still there. One side of its face was torn to shreds, with skin scraped off to the bone.
Oh, shit! Go! Go!
Doc and Kirby ran past Bell, who quickly unsheathed his blade and stood with one hand gripping the rope. The rail jerked taut as 600 pounds of trainer pulled on it, using the rope to maintain its balance. Bell struck, and the heavy blade parted the rope cleanly. The trainer fell.
Whoa! God.
With slugs sparking all around them, the trio struggled upward.
Have they given up on us?
No! They're just running back to get a better angle!
It was all the break the escapees needed. Pushing even harder, they drove themselves up the slick grade, around the last two switchbacks, and into the impenetrable cloud bank. The swirling gray mist was ice cold, and there was so much water vapor it was difficult to breathe. It was so dark they couldn't see 4 feet in front of their faces. Ryan stood amongst the crowd. It didn't surprise him when the mutie hunter had cut the rope. It was exactly what he would have done. Still holding on to the slack and useless rope, the trainer had lost its footing and fell backward, off the edge of the path. The straight drop had been almost 200 feet. The crew and battlers loved it. Suddenly, the battered trainer began to stir.
Fucking thing's unkillable!
Quivering from head to foot, blood pouring from its open maw, the trainer managed to get to its feet. Ryan, noticing that everybody's eyes were on the creature, unslung his stire. He shouldered the rifle. Cheek pressed against the stock's rest, Ryan acquired the target, then compensated for the up-angle bullet rise by holding it a good foot and a half low. The thing's mouth was gaping open.
Wait, One-Eye, what do you think you're doing?
A hand gripped the stire's barrel and jerked the weapon to the side. Ryan stared nose to nose with the uniformed captain.
I'll take that long blaster.
Sure you will. You probably want this one, too.
The captain glanced down and saw the SIG's muzzle aimed at his heart. Then he looked up at the one-eyed man's fierce smile. Ryan had to give the guy credit. He barely flinched.
Give him up, now!
As Ryan relinquished his weapons, he saw the trainer start up the treacherous cliff path. Without the rope to pull on, its progress was slow and intermittent. It slipped and scrambled on the slope of wet rock, falling to its knees, getting up, falling again. Ryan was relieved that Doc had made it. He had no idea what was going on in that scrambled brain, whether the old bastard had gone delusional as he had on other notable occasions, thinking he was back in Victorian times, addressing his peers in the Royal Academy of Science, or some such crap. It was also possible that with the help of the mutie hunters, Doc had come up with a plan to flush out and chill Magus.
All right, all of you! Show's over! Move!
The uniform started sweeping the beach, herding the recruits at gunpoint back onto the pier and into 8 waiting rowboats. The boats were crewed by the recruits and commanded by the trainers. As Ryan stepped into his boat, he looked at the faces of the other conscripted rowers, haggard, dirty, exhausted, but above all, afraid. Every step they had taken since leaving Morro Bay was a step farther from safety. and deeper into a bottomless pit. Only the islanders held their heads high. There was no fear in their eyes, just cold, seething anger. Mildred, Christy, and JB weren't afraid either, but they were disconcerted and even hurt by Doc's abandoning them as he was. As Ryan took a seat beside Jack on the thwart, he could see that the albino was troubled over the loss, too. The trainer stamped his foot on the gunwale and made a motion with both arms. Universal sign language, forget rowing. As they pulled away from the pier, uniforms and four other boats tagged alongside, keeping guard.
Doc gone. Two beauty hunters followed us from the Vegas pie shop to the coast.
What? What that means?
Yeah. Me and Tuz in the same gateway we did. Been after Doc a long time.
You're right. I saw the way they were hanging around him. Doc's been a popular guy lately. Question is, what do these guys want?
And why'd he go along?
The two men rode in silence for a while, falling into the rhythm of the work, watching the bleak landscape glide past as they angled toward the cove's eastern point.
Doc no coward.
I know that. We all know that. He's proved it to us over and over again. He had to have had a good reason for taking off that way.
Beauty hunters tricked him?
Maybe. He was acting funny after we got off the ship.
Doc no chip astute.
Yeah, that's true too.
Scrubbed the mission?
No way. We don't even know where he went.
Top of the mountain.
Maybe. Maybe there's a gateway up there, and he's already long gone. Without blasters, we can't follow him and find out. The uniforms would cut us down, or the enforcers would catch us. We're going to do this training, whatever the hell it is, and hope to get our shot at Magus before it's over. If we live through all that, we'll see about catching up with Doc.